Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, a visionary filmmaker who intertwined hope and horror.
And why the Sonoran Desert is now prone to wildfire.
But first, Governor Katie Hobbs on Friday unveiled her budget proposal for the fiscal year that'll start on July 1st. The $17.6 billion plan aims to scale back parts of the state's universal school voucher program, put more money into the housing trust fund, and help families afford childcare, among many other provisions. Our co-host, Mark Brody, spoke earlier this morning with Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services about the plan, as well as GOP lawmakers' response to it. And with ESAs and childcare garnering many of the headlines about the budget, they started with some of Howie's key takeaways from the proposal.
Well, I think you're starting off with the right assumptions. The governor figures, look, I don't believe that we should have expanded vouchers to everyone who's eligible. For the simple reason that a lot of the folks who have signed up were already going to private and parochial schools, were already being homeschooled at the parents' expense. And so why are we doing that? That gets into a large philosophical discussion of, well, aren't parents entitled to make their own decisions and shouldn't they get their share of the tax dollars back? She's obviously given up on getting rid of it. So she said, look, why don't we means test this and say, okay, if you are not one of the people who was eligible before, you know, children with special needs, children going to DNF schools, we will go ahead and say at family income of up to $100,000, you still get a full voucher. And then scaling it back after that, so at the point that a family income is $200,000, there's no voucher eligibility. I don't know if this is going to be any more successful. I mean, I appreciate what she's trying to do, but this is not a financial issue for lawmakers. This is a philosophical issue. So it's an interesting idea, as I said. She thinks she can save $150 million for other projects. I see this pretty much as a non-starter.
What about some of the governor's other proposals, Howie? What kind of responses have those gotten from GOP lawmakers? Like, does it seem as though there's any area where the two sides might be in agreement here?
Oh, I think everyone agrees in some sort of housing fix. There's no question, but if the median cost of a family home is $400,000+, and it goes up and down, that's hardly affordable. I think there's some agreement that maybe we can do something about that whole idea of vacation rentals, short-term rentals. I think that there's some common ground on a non-budget issue in terms of removing some of the barriers, the red tape that it takes. Now, the question becomes, what is the state's role in terms of financing? The governor has been very big on issues of money into the housing trust fund, and they can then invest in developers, actual grants to people of limited income to help them with down payment assistance, issues like that, rental assistance, all of that. These become important to a number of individual people. There's a lot of folks who say, you know, what is the role of government? This also gets into the issue of childcare. I think there are a lot of traditional Republicans who like the idea of helping to subsidize businesses to provide childcare. But there are other folks who say, now, wait a second, why aren't we spending our time reducing taxes? And then perhaps businesses will pay employees more and they'll be able to afford their own childcare.
All right. Well, budget, of course, starting to heat up, usually a little bit later on in the session. Some initial comments on it, most likely coming from some Republican lawmakers this week after seeing the proposal from the governor on Friday. Howie, let me ask you about a couple of bills coming up this week in committee. One of them deals with voting. Of course, elections expected to be another big issue this year. This measure by Representative Rachel Keschel would ban voting centers. It would eliminate on-site early voting locations, limit precincts to a certain number of registered voters. Seems like there's a lot of stuff in there specifically dealing with early voting.
Exactly. And it doesn't specifically get rid of early voting. I mean, that's become very popular. What I think she's trying to do is say there's no reason that we have to have early voting if, in fact, we can go ahead and actually count ballots at the precincts. And that's why she says, if you have these vote centers like they do here in Maricopa County, you have, you know, tens of thousands of people, you have long lines. If you have people voting from home from their vote centers, you don't have to even coordinate which ballot goes to which precinct, and you can have enough volunteers to go ahead and count them there that night. As I say, you know, this is I think a means to an end here. The other issue, which is not up this week, but we've obviously talked about, is the question of, if we're going to keep early voting, what's the deadline for people to drop off their early ballots?
Right.
There is a lot more sentiment on this, despite the governor's threat to veto it, to say, well, if in fact you've got a ballot and you're getting it 29 days before the vote day, you should be able to fill it out, figure it out. If you can't figure it out beforehand, you know, dropping it off on the day of really does complicate the system. Because remember, it isn't a question of, oh, we'll just open it there. No, because it's an early ballot, you have to go ahead and set it aside. You have to verify the signature on the outside of the ballot, and then you can open it, and then you can count it. That doesn't start sometimes for 2 or 3 days after the rest of the elections. So I think there's some sentiment in there to perhaps saying, no, if you haven't figured it out by the Friday before, you know, maybe you should have to come in on election day and vote a live ballot.
Sure. Howie, let me ask you about, before we wrap up, one other bill coming up this week, which seems to borrow an idea from the British Parliament, in which the governor would be required to come on down to the legislature once a month and field some questions from lawmakers.
Well, if you've ever watched C-SPAN, you'll find some things they pick up from BBC, where the prime minister comes in and he takes questions both from his own party and from the opposition party. It is in some ways must-see TV because of the fact that everyone there thinks, here's my chance to show off how brilliant I am. And some of it is useful, quite frankly. I think that there's a reason to have, you know, the executive in a parliamentary state that's a little different, answer some questions and do it on the record. My concern is, as I mentioned, you know, making it must-see TV also means there are going to be gotcha questions in there, certainly from the opposition party, the idea of trying to embarrass the governor. It does have some merit, though. I mean, you know, if in fact they ask a gotcha question, will the listeners and will the viewers know that's a gotcha question? And will they think less of the questioner and think more of the governor if he or she handles it in a much better fashion? Now, of note on this is Alexander Culloden, who's a representative, who's introducing this, is saying this is not actually out to get Katie Hobbs because the fact it wouldn't take effect until after the 2026 election. So it could very well be a Republican governor at that point. I like the idea. I mean, I'm a big believer in asking tough questions of the chief executive. And of course, part of the problem we have as journalists is we can only do that when he or she agrees to have a press conference, and sometimes those are few and far between.
Right. All right. That is Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. Howie, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
And have a great morning.
Republicans at the state capitol are moving fast to move some of their favorite legislation, and at the top of their list is Arizona's elections and putting the early back in early voting, as it's being called. It's an attempt to speed up the counting of ballots so we can get results in our state faster. In Arizona, there are often races where the winners aren't clear for several days or even up to 2 weeks, especially in close races. And in order to make that counting faster, Republicans want to stop people from being able to drop off early ballots at polling places up until 7 o'clock on election day. Democrats at the legislature have called this a power grab, but our next guest says they should find something else to complain about. Lori Roberts is a columnist for the Arizona Republic's opinion pages, and she's on the line now to tell us more. Good morning, Lori.
Good morning.
Okay, so tell us first just why you think this is a good idea, why you think this is a good fix to this issue that is becoming, you know, louder and louder every election cycle, that our elections take too long, the races take too long to count.
Well, I think the problem is we've always taken a long time to count, but as Arizona races have gotten closer, we've just begun to notice. And it started maybe in 2020. As it takes so much longer to find out than the rest of the nation, the conspiracy crowd immediately goes to getting riled up and saying, oh, there's obviously a problem with our elections. The fix is in. And it erodes confidence in our elections. We need to get with the rest of the country, or most of the rest of the country, mm-hmm. I should say, and be able to find out who actually wins our election within a few days, rather than waiting 10, 12, 13, 14 days to find out who wins some of these vital key races that have become oh so close in recent years.
Right. And it turns out that those early lates that I described there, the people who drop off their ballots, those early ballots at the polling place late on election day, those are the ones kind of that are the culprits here. Democrats are calling this a power grab. They say it's voter suppression, essentially, though, that it's like another way to restrict voting. A lot of people who vote this way, too, 250,000 in November. What do you think of that argument? Like, do you think it would make it harder for a whole lot of Arizonans to vote?
Well, let's talk about the different ways in which you can vote now. You have 27 days. In the 27 days leading up to the election, you can mail in your early ballot. That's 27 days that you have to vote. Or in those last final days, because the mail wouldn't get it there quickly enough, you can drop it off at any voting center. You can drop it off, you know, in a drop box. There are a couple of them around the county as well. You can vote on an emergency basis the Saturday and Monday before the elections, or you can come to the polls, vote the old-fashioned way. I don't see how it's suppression to say that you ought to put a little effort in and get your early ballot, which you've had for nearly a month, get it in the mail in time for it to be counted by the Friday before the election.
One of the worries in election circles, right, though, in politics is that it's too hard for voters already. Like, it's confusing. There are these incredibly long ballots we're facing now. Like, that ballot takes time to research, to figure out what you think about things, what things actually mean. I mean, do you think that people are not putting in an effort?
Well, I think that people are putting in an effort at the end, at the very end of the cycle, or maybe not much of an effort. But if you want to vote early, you have 27 days to get it done. How many more days do you need to do research on these things? And the other thing I should mention is you can still bring your early ballot to a polling place. You just have to show ID and then feed it into a tabulation machine under this proposal.
You'd have to wait in line. Yeah.
The problem is that when you just drop off an early ballot and it has to have signature verification and all those things that can't by law then begin to happen until the day after the election, that's what's holding up the results. So if you brought your, if you want to bring your early ballot to the polls, all this bill does is say, rather than dropping it into a box to be processed in a day or two or in a week, you have to show ID to bypass that signature requirement and then just tabulate it right there. So you, again, it doesn't really change what you can do. It simply means you might have to stand in line for a few minutes.
Right. It's waiting in line.
I don't see the suppression involved here. I mean, is it inconvenient to have to stand in a line? Sure it is. But when you go to buy eggs at the grocery store, don't you also stand in line? Isn't our democracy worth at least that? I see plenty of efforts in Arizona to suppress votes over the years, but I just don't see this as one of them.
And you said this does work differently in other states, in most other states.
Yeah, most other states, you can find out who won the election before a week, week and a half. Now, some states still have a hard time figuring these things out. But this particular bill is modeled after the law in Florida, where they can count ballots fairly quickly. And this idea of cutting off early ballot drop-offs the Friday before the election seems to make a difference in the handling of these ballots so that election officials aren't just have an avalanche of ballots dropped on them at the last minute that they can't even get to until the Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, week from Friday after the election.
So this bill had no trouble getting through committee at the state capitol. Very likely, though, that Katie Hobbs would veto something like this if it reaches her desk. Do you think Republicans might go around her, send this to voters? And if so, I mean, like, would voters say no thanks?
I think this is a pretty popular idea. I've seen polls on both sides, but the poll that I saw that was done by a Democratic-leaning group didn't really explain to voters the trade-off. It just said, do you want the right to drop off your ballot at the polls. It didn't go on to explain that that's a trade-off for having election results later. So the polling that I've seen that I think is maybe more representative of what people think is that I think most people think it's a reasonable trade-off to, you know, put the early back in early ballots, as I like to say. No, I think it's a pretty popular idea. I think it will breeze through the legislature, and I think that it will be vetoed by this governor. And quite likely they'll put it on the ballot next year. All right. It'll be a great election issue for them.
It'll be a great election issue for them. We'll talk about it more then. That is Lori Roberts, a columnist for the Arizona Republic, joining us this morning. Lori, thank you so much for coming on. Appreciate your take care.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, the consequences of Spotify shaking up the music business.
It gives them something to sell to advertisers. It also, you know, allows them to make personalized recommendations to users. And then the data itself also becomes this commodity that they can sell.
How Spotify has changed the way we listen to music.
But first, watching the wildfires devastate a major U.S. city in Los Angeles has many of us wondering, could it happen here? But while you might assume that wildfires are not something that can really happen in the desert scrubland of the Sonoran Desert, our next guest says that is changing fast. Ben Wilder is the director of Next Generation Sonoran Desert Researchers based in Tucson. And he told me their research shows our ecosystem is changing and making us more at risk to wildfire than ever before.
I mean, I think one of the big shifts we need to make mentally and in action is we now live in the desert in a fire-prone ecosystem. Mm-hmm. And that's a big, big change, both in terms of how we think of the desert and also how the desert has functioned for hundreds of years, if not longer.
Okay, so tell us why that is. This has to do with invasive plants, it sounds like.
That's the culprit. That's the mechanism behind it. So the invasive species, especially we're talking about grasses, or some small forbs, you know, annual plants. And these are species that either respond to winter rains and or summer rains. And starting in the late 1990s, early 2000s, for various reasons, some of which we don't really know very well, they started to expand dramatically. And that kind of coincided with the drought period, too, we've been experiencing. And they essentially create fuel that links the vegetation throughout the desert that then can carry fires. That's a difference than the desert has previously been. I think many of us that know the desert, when we hike, you kind of just think you can kind of not get yourself stuck by cacti because you kind of can dodge them, walk around them. But that space around the fuels or around the vegetation is being closed up by these invasive species, either annual grasses after wet winters or perennial bunch grasses. These grasses that grow in response to summer rains.
So we're shifting ecosystems essentially in the Sonoran Desert here from patchy kind of desert scrub to grasslands. That's a big shift. Do we know any reasons why this happened, how these invasive plants got here?
So we absolutely know how they got here, and almost always the answer is us. So people brought them in for cattle forage or erosion control primarily, and both from Mediterranean ecosystems, so regions that have dry summers and wet winters, or sub-Saharan African ecosystems with arid conditions, not too different from our own. But one of the key differences is these species are from ecosystems that have fire as part of the ecosystem dynamics. You know, they recruit very well after fire. And so here in the Sonoran Desert, they are outcompeting native species. And then if a fire does happen that they're able to carry the fuels, they grow back even stronger after the fire.
Okay, wow. Okay. So are we seeing this happen? Are we seeing wildfires happening in desert regions that didn't used to see wildfires already today?
Very much so. The first inflection point was around 2005. And then the second one was in 2020. And what these 2 years had in common was El Nino conditions that drove a lot of winter rain. Now, with the invasive species fuel sources that have such large areas, the fire spread dramatically. And in 2020, especially in the valley, if you're familiar with the Telegraph or the bushfires,
yeah,
the culprits are invasive species, and they're, you know, hundreds of thousands of acres of the desert burned.
So the fact that we haven't seen a major wildfire super close to the metro area in Phoenix or in Tucson, is that just luck at this point? Is this a matter of time?
So there's a combination of factors here. So you have the fuel source now increasingly with these invasive species.
Right.
You have ignition points, which are urban primarily, especially along roadsides. And roadsides and these invasive species, they go together very well because the extra moisture and the heat along the asphalt is a kind of perfect environment for these weedy species. And then the third element is kind of climate ingredient, which is dry, hot conditions and wind. And that comes together most frequently in June in our region. And so it's just kind of a matter of time until these pieces click together, like happened in 2020 with the bushfire and others. So yes, it is kind of a matter of time until these conditions come together. And I think one of the big fears is that the worst case scenarios of when you have in our region that is kind of looking in June, it can be other times of the year too, but we have 115 degree heat, incredible winds, and then a fire breaking out that just is impossible to control.
Let me ask you about what should be, what could be done here. Like, what could local and state governments be doing? What do you think they should be doing to address this kind of new reality?
Well, you know, I think one of the things that is a positive in what we're talking about is this is a very much a process. You know, you talked about the transition of ecosystems. We call it grassification of the Sonoran Desert. And it's happening in real time, but it's not a fait accompli. It hasn't been done. So real active management can absolutely be taken in a couple of ways. You know, the most important thing with invasive species and the dynamic we're talking about is when you have a new population of buffle grass or fountain grass, or especially stinknet, get rid of it. You know, like, don't just sit there and be like, oh, it's small now. Okay, it's fine. It's like, no, you know, take an afternoon, you know, be careful about, you know, spreading the seed or whatnot, but just get rid of that freaking patch in your backyard. So that's an easy thing we can do, and that's at multiple scales, right? Like, so your backyard, your neighborhood association, city parks, cities, county, state, right? I think it's about mitigation and then steps, and so fire breaks are a really important thing, and thinking about how we manage fire in the desert. I know working with Tonto National Forest and other land management agencies, what is the role of prescribed burns, or what steps can we take to avoid the multiple thousands of acres of lost landscape? Because once these fires do happen, the desert will never come back the way it was. And so there's a lot of things we can do to really mitigate the threat of fires. And now's the time to do it.
Is any of that happening at this point? Like, is this even part of the conversation? As you said, this represents a really major paradigm shift just in how we think about where we live.
It is. It is starting, but the resources and the addressing the problem is not scaling with the scope of the problem itself. I think one of the things that I'm seeing is there are so many problems and threats and challenges that need to be addressed that this one keeps sliding down the list because it's not actively burning, because it is literally. But the problem is when you do get the worst case scenario, all those ingredients coming together, it's too late to act. And so now is the time to be proactive. And the cost of taking action now are orders of magnitude less, and in some ways, you know, priceless if you're talking about the loss of life, than not acting or acting after fires have happened. So yes, things are happening, but they need to scale up.
Okay. Ben Wilder, director of Next Generation Sonoran Desert Researchers. He's based in Tucson. Ben, thank you for coming on. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Lauren.
This, as I'm sure many of you know, is the music that plays over the opening credits of Twin Peaks, one of the many seminal works of filmmaker David Lynch, who passed away last week at the age of 78. Like many of Lynch's works, Twin Peaks told a story that was, on the surface, harrowing and bleak. A murder in a small town augurs the return of a mysterious ancient curse that reveals the seething amoral underbelly of the community. But as terrifying as that sounds, I'm willing to bet that for those of you who love Twin Peaks, hearing this music is a source of comfort. When people talk about Twin Peaks, they usually don't talk about the story, Or they usually don't talk about the story whenever they talk about Lynch's works. Most of his fans would tell you the story is not what matters. It's the feeling. Like the best artists, Lynch's work does more than engage your mind. It makes your heart beat to a different rhythm. And that rhythm reverberates long after the story ends. So, how did he do that? Joining us now to remember David Lynch is Jason Woodbury. Jason is a writer, a musician, and a cultural commentator on shows like the Transmissions podcast from Aquarium Drunkard, and he is a lifelong David Lynch fan. Jason, good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Sam.
So what do you make of that idea, Jason, that there was and is a David Lynch feeling?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because the term Lynchian has been coined to describe his signature appeal, right? The thing that only he could do. But I often think that when people talk about Lynchian, they sort of miss some of the qualities there, because as you mentioned, Twin Peaks is certainly a show laced with dread, but it's also laced with so much humor and love and joy and kindness and really, really quixotically funny scenes. So it's a very layered, multi-dimensional feel that I think that he created. And it's funny because since David Lynch passed away, I've been rewatching Twin Peaks with my wife, Becky, and when you're binging a show, eventually you start skipping the theme song. But when it comes to Twin Peaks, you can't skip the theme song.
It's
part of the meditative. It gets you ready for what you're about to see.
Yeah, it's kind of the emotional ramp into that world.
And so beautiful, so beautiful. It's
so
a very beautiful.
Beautiful
melody. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, much like the theme song, there are just countless really illustrative moments from his work. And we could talk about so many of them, but you've identified a few that in your mind really illustrate this idea of the special sauce of David Lynch. Let's hear one clip now from, I believe it's Mulholland Drive.
Man's attitude goes some ways, the way his life will be. Is that something you might agree with?
Sure.
Now, did you answer because that's what you thought I wanted to hear? Or did you think about what I said and answer because you truly believe that to be right?
I agree with what you said. Truly.
What'd I say?
Chilling. Tell us about that clip, Jason.
Well, I mean, probably one of my favorite things about the work of David Lynch is how often his projects feature mysterious characters who you don't know what they are, but you get the sense that they are agents of some sort of far off, beyond cosmic force, right? Like Lynch is like, he's this guy who can center the cosmic in the most sort of mundane. The character that we just heard speak is sort of dressed as like a vintage Hollywood cowboy.
Yeah.
And he's talking to Justin Theroux's movie director character and sort of grilling him in this like mysterious, this cadence that just makes you want to know what's going on. And that's something that I think threads all through his work, is this sense of mystery, the sense of forces beyond us playing on or with us even, you know? And I think that's really essential to Lynch's worldview.
Yeah, that makes me think of my favorite line from Blue Velvet, where Kyle MacLachlan's character is talking to Laura Dern, and she basically says to him, like, why are you so mixed up in this criminal investigation? And he says, I'm seeing something that was always hidden. I'm involved in a mystery. I'm in the middle of a mystery. And
yeah.
She says, you love mysteries that much? And he's like, oh, yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely, absolutely. And I think, you know, the writer Christine McKenna in her Lynch biography, Room to Dream, she says Lynch's work resides in the complicated zone where the beautiful and the damned collide. And that is obviously a mystery-laden zone, if there is one, you know?
Yes. Well, speaking of the damned, I also want to talk to you about the role of horror in his work. And we've got another clip here. This is from Twin Peaks, The Return.
This is the water. And this is the well. Drink full and ascend. The horse is the white of the eyes and dark within.
Okay, the dark within. Let's talk about it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, I think, so if you're looking for sort of an interesting introduction to David Lynch and you're new to his work, you might want to watch episode 8 of Twin Peaks, The Return, which that clip is from, because it's almost a little mini movie within the show itself that is related to the plot, but you could watch it without having to know anything. And I think it would give you a very good feel for David Lynch. That's obviously a terrifying clip. And it's set in this small town, and this is some sort of infernal, you know, cosmic entity, a woodsman, a demon, maybe. And he's taken over a small town radio station and is broadcasting this sort of cryptic message that is casting a spell over things. But yeah, you know, I think that like Lynch is defined by that understanding of dualities and opposites, right? Good and evil, spirit and matter, you know, love, lust, all these things. And he's not afraid to go very, very, very into the realm of horror. And he's not thought of as a horror director all the time, but you could make a good case for a lot of his films as being horror films, at least at certain points, you know? And who doesn't feel like life is a little bit like a horror film sometimes? You know what I mean? There's a lot of reasons to feel that way.
Yes, but I would also say those opposites are often at play, not just in his oeuvre, but within individual works. If we count all three seasons of Twin Peaks as one work, he's also operating at the other end of that emotional spectrum, which brings us to this last clip I want to play. This is from the original run of Twin Peaks.
This must be where pies go when they die.
Would you like some pie?
Massive, massive quantities and a glass of water, sweetheart. My socks are on fire.
Two more pieces of this incredible pie.
So, Jason, in closing, let's talk about the wonder of pie and coffee and dessert to David Lynch.
Yeah, I mean, like, Twin Peaks is a very breakfast and dessert-coated program. And I think that's really what makes Lynch so powerful, is that just as he could express the depths of human depravity and darkness, and you know, these inexplicable grotesque scenes of an ear in the grass or whatever, he also just loved absolutely this sort of wholesome middle American mid-century idea of just like, you know, offering a stranger a slice of pie, seeing everybody as a potential friend, you know, doo-wop in the air, this sort of, you know, Lynch is from the time where the teenager was invented as an archetype, you know? And I think that just like a sort of innocence really pervades his work and gives it an undergirding that makes even those darkest moments, you know, it kind of casts light on them in this weird way. I think Lynch was all about accepting the darkness within ourselves, but also, and I think this is crucial, really accepting the possibility of our own goodness too, and our goodness to other people, and our ability to see others not through the lens of fear, but through a lens of love. And I think that is, you know, so central to his work, and it's certainly something I've been reflecting on since his passing.
Yes, a timely message, if ever there was one. Well, that is Jason Woodbury, who is, among other things, the host of the Transmissions podcast. Jason, thank you so much.
Thanks so much. Everybody here at 850 West Lincoln, where I'm recording, this is an absolute monument to Lynch. I'm looking at Sam Means's signed Eraserhead poster over there. So we send love from 850. Thanks so much, Sam.
All right.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Amidst the wall-to-wall coverage of the domestic implications of President Trump's return to power, governments around the world are also closely monitoring his early maneuvers. Joining me now via Skype to discuss some initial clues about Trump's international intentions is the BBC's Pete Ross. Pete, let's begin in the Middle East, where a ceasefire in Gaza is holding for a third day. What's the latest there, and what can we expect over the next few days?
That's right, Sam. The fragile ceasefire in Gaza appears to be holding for now, which, as you say, is in its third day. One thing it means is that aid can now get into the territory more freely and easily than it has been up to now. Since the ceasefire and hostage release deal between Israel and Hamas took effect on Sunday, the United Nations says that more than 1,500 aid trucks have crossed into Gaza. The trucks are bringing in desperately needed food, tents, blankets, mattresses, clothing, all the essentials required to get the hundreds of thousands of displaced Palestinians, hopefully through the winter, and all of which have been stuck outside Gaza for months. Meanwhile, how optimistic can we be that the ceasefire will continue to hold? Well, one thing that could put it in jeopardy is events in the West Bank. A large number of security forces are said to have entered the flashpoint city of Jenin overnight. Israeli security forces say they launched what the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu described as an operation to, quote, eradicate terrorism in the occupied West Bank. Palestinian health officials say at least 7 people have been killed and 35 injured. Today's action there comes after Donald Trump's announcement that he was lifting sanctions against violent settlers in the occupied West Bank. And since then, he's also expressed his doubts that the truce will hold through all 3 phases. He said to reporters, "It's not our war, it's their war." At the same time, we've been hearing from his new special envoy to the Middle East, Steve Witkoff, who indicated his ongoing commitment to the deal.
Wow. Well, many threads to follow there. And of course, never any easy answers or pat storylines coming out of that conflict. Let's move to Europe now, Pete. The World Economic Forum begins today in Davos, Switzerland. The annual event brings together international leaders to address key global issues and challenges. What's likely to be on the agenda this year?
This year's meeting is titled Collaboration for the Intelligent Age. So discussions are likely to span geoeconomic uncertainty, artificial intelligence, growth, safeguarding the planet, and various other topics, no doubt including the ongoing conflict in Ukraine and the ceasefire in Gaza, which we talked about just a moment ago. Now, a slew of heads of state, politicians, and business moguls are set to attend. Top political leaders taking part include Donald Trump. He's expected to join via video link for what's been described as an interactive dialogue with participants. That's going to take place on Wednesday. The president of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, she's going to be there. President of Argentina, Javier Milei, Olaf Scholz, the leader of Germany, President of the European Parliament, Roberta Metsola, and the President of South Africa, Cyril Ramaphosa, is also supposed to be in attendance, as is the President of Israel and the Prime Minister of the Palestinian National Authority. However, there will also be a number of notable absentees. Of the group of 7, the G7 industrialized nations, which of course you'll know includes the US, Europe's biggest economies, France, Germany, Italy, and the United Kingdom, and then Canada and Japan, the only head of state attending out of that group in person is the outgoing German Chancellor Olaf Scholz. So I think that's a point worth making a note of. Now, there's often no official reason given for a lack of participation in Davos, though pressing domestic problems are often cited and have kept, you know, heads of government away from the event in the past. In recent years, there's also been a bit of ambivalence over attending an event that has been accused of being elite and out of touch. Whether that's the case this year, we'll just have to wait and see. But if I had to take a guess at the one moment likely to grab headlines from the event this week, well, that would probably likely be the reaction to whatever Donald Trump has to say on Wednesday.
Yes, driving the storyline as he loves to do. All right, well, let's move finally to Thailand, Pete, where same-sex marriage will become legal later this week. What can you tell us about this one?
Yeah, this week Thailand becomes one of the few places in Asia to recognize same-sex unions. Thailand's landmark marriage equality bill was officially written into law last year in September after it was endorsed by the king there. LGBTQ plus couples will be able to register marriages when the law takes effect on Thursday, and it makes Thailand the third place in Asia to be able to do so after Taiwan and Nepal. Thailand has a reputation for acceptance and inclusivity, but has struggled for many years to pass a marriage equality law. However, this time the law was supported by the government and major opposition parties, and it passed through the parliament there with 400 votes to 10, and then the Senate 130 to 4. So broad support, and the king gave his royal assent. What it means is that same-sex couples will have the same rights as other couples, including the right to adopt children and inherit property. Thailand has long been considered a haven for the LGBTQ plus people in a region where such attitudes are rare. Some say that the LGBTQ plus people still face discrimination and barriers. However, this is, they would say, a step in the right direction.
Well, a notably Trumpless update to end on from the BBC's Pete Ross. Thank you so much for keeping us in the loop as always, Pete.
Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure to be with you. Thanks, Sam.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. If you think Spotify was designed to be a music platform, you have been tricked. Liz Pelly has the receipts.
There's a quote that I have from one of the founders of Spotify who is talking about how in the early days, Spotify was an advertising product in search of a traffic source.
That's right. In the late 90s and early 2000s, at the height of the music piracy craze, two ad tech veterans had a revelation. People were not going to give up on unlimited access to all the music in the world, and record companies weren't going to give up on making money off that music. So these two guys realized they could make money off of both of those groups. In other words, they realized that music was the ideal traffic source to build a lucrative ad business, and that business became Spotify. Pelly tells these stories and more in her new book, Mood Machine. As she told me recently, her reporting reveals that Spotify's goal is not so much music discovery, but rather redefining our relationship to music.
Over the years in Spotify's own marketing materials to advertisers, for example, they have put forth their image of kind of the model Spotify user's day. And it is someone who wakes up and listens to their morning rise playlist, puts on a news podcast during breakfast, has a playlist that they listen to on their commute to work, has a focus playlist that they listen to at their desk while they're working. Then maybe they have like a chat podcast that they listen to during lunch, more focused music during their afternoon, maybe a yoga mix that they listen to after work. And then they have a dinner playlist that they listen to. And then they have a wind down playlist that they listen to before they go to sleep.
Yeah. And as they're listening to all of this music nonstop all day long on Spotify, right? Spotify is just ingesting all of this information about this person into their system, which serves their ad model.
Correct. Yeah. So the data that they collect on users is useful to them for multiple different reasons. On one hand, it gives them something to sell to advertisers. It also, allows them to make personalized recommendations to users. And then the data itself also becomes this commodity that they can sell. You know, I talk in the book about how for years, Spotify has been selling mood data to this marketing firm called WPP. They've had a longstanding partnership for years. It's just one example of, how they're able to take user data and sort of sell it in the data marketplace as part of their advertising efforts. the goal isn't really ever to recommend you something that they know you like, but it's to recommend you something that they know that you'll stream.
Right. Something that will keep you on Spotify for as long as possible.
Exactly. And I always try to make this really specific distinction because the in the narrative that streaming companies or algorithmic recommenders might put forth, you know, it's this line about we are able to tell what you might want to listen to before you know you want to listen to it. And I think it's really important to make a distinction between them being able to know what you like or know like your musical desires versus knowing what you won't hit skip on.
Right. And this is also a critical distinction because if you think of, say, for example, I mean, I'm a huge Decemberists fan and my favorite record of theirs is The Hazards of Love. And that is this hour-long operatic story where the lyrics are really intricate, the music is really intricate, the way the two relate to each other is super interesting, and it's a real emotional roller coaster. But in Spotify's framing, what serves their aims best is not that you have an emotional relationship with the music, it's that Spotify is there to kind of create a general emotional framework for your day.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, the streaming recommendation model would be more about, okay, what is the song on this Decemberist album that is really important to you that you have streamed the most times, and how can we take that track out of the context of the album and find the appropriate like daily mix for it in order to make it part of some sort of, you know, emotionally themed algorithmic mix that we'll put on the front page for you.
Right, which is how you get these Spotify playlists called like Suburban Coffee Shop or like Autumn Stroll or whatever. But this brings us to an extended sequence in the book that is, in my opinion, genuinely upsetting, which is the phenomenon of ghost artists. Tell us what the ghost artists are and how Spotify uses them.
So over the years, you know, you maybe every few years would see like a viral post on social media from someone saying, oh, I was checking out like, you know, this study playlist on Spotify, and I realized that none of the artists on the playlist exist. They're all, you know, attributed to this same stock music company, Epidemic Sound, based in Sweden. And as I started reporting the book and talking to musicians and former Spotify employees and people who worked in the music business at the time, you know, I was able to uncover that this actually is a specific team within Spotify. Is a program called Perfect Fit Content. There's a list of specific licensors, these production companies who provide these tracks at a lower royalty rate. And then there's a team of editors internally at Spotify that is sort of dedicated to watching over the types of playlists that this music does really well in. And they clearly are giving preferential treatment to these tracks.
Right. And one of the things that's troubling about that is that it allows Spotify to just insert this kind of musical slop into your playlists because they've already convinced you that music is just something you have on in the background and that it's not really about the music anyway. And that allows them to spend less money paying royalties to artists who are really trying to make music as art.
Yeah, for sure. And then, you know, something that else that I think really complicates it too is that at least some of the composers who are making this work for these production companies also are musicians who, you know, have artistic practices, who, right, you know, can't make enough income with their own art through their own, you know, releases that they put out. So they're turning to this work as kind of like a side gig. And in interviewing them, they would tell me, I just make my tracks for this production company. I submit them and I don't really know what happens after that. Yeah. So I just feel like that's like an interesting point to emphasize too, is that there are so many different dimensions to the way in which this affects musicians.
Absolutely. Well, so Liz, I'm guessing that there's a lot of people who might read your book or perhaps listen to this conversation and think, I don't want to use Spotify anymore. So as somebody who has reported on this in such depth, where would you suggest people go if they don't want to give their money or data to Spotify?
Yeah, I think a lot of the criticisms made in the book are criticisms of the streaming model more broadly. For me as a listener, I'm not someone who uses streaming services. You know, individual solutions to collective problems can feel really unsatisfying. But as a music listener, I also think that it's important to, you know, support the cultural ecosystems that you want to see thrive in the world. So buying music directly from musicians, building a library, sharing the music that you're excited about, listening to independent local radio.
We like that.
Supporting independent music retail, you know, supporting the independent music ecosystems that exist entirely outside of the corporate music industry.
Well, Liz Pelly is a music journalist and the author of the new book, Mood Machine. Liz, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you for having me.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.